Thank you, Vandana. I'm going to ask Gerrymander to come up and introduce our wonderful last speaker tonight. I just want to say, as in my closing remarks, just to thank the panel so much and to say and to thank you all for your incredible stamina and passion and interest. When I took part in the streets of Seattle on the famous day that I had a button that said the day the world stands still. That was before we made it stand still. I phoned my mother, who lives in Ottawa, and I was, of course, on the West Coast, so there was a three-hour difference, but I knew she would be watching television and seeing all the violence and so on, and I was worried about I wanted to let her know I was all right, and then, secondly, to get a feeling of what she thought. And she said, well, dear, it's always too bad if there is that, but you know, it's like the French Revolution. You can only treat people badly for so long, and then they talk back. So I just want to say, if Kevin Donaher is in the audience, the corporations didn't get my mama, Kevin, and I tell you, we are changing hearts and minds by the moment. Thank you to the panel.
It will be truly an honor for me to introduce our last guest, but before I do that, I just want to say this is a most amazing audience. You've been here for most of you have been here for 12 and a half hours. You don't even look tired. And there are also two overflow rooms that are watching this on a video feed. They've been here 12 and a half hours. Thank you to you, too. We've heard 35 amazing speakers. I want to thank a few people before I turn it over to Ralph, who have done so much work to make this possible. This is really not an easy thing to pull off, to bring all these people from all over the world to run an event like this. And I want to particularly thank a small list of people. First of all, thanks to the Founder United Methodist Church for providing this facility. It's been a great place to have this, and they've been very, very kind to us since the beginning as we made all our arrangements. And then to our co-sponsors in this event, the Institute for Policy Studies, Public Citizen, Global Exchange, the International Center for Technology Assessment, and the 20 Years is Enough Coalition, and Friends of the Earth as well. Thank you very much. Then I particularly want to thank the staff people who worked for a long time, for over the last 2 months, to pull this off. Most importantly, Debbie Barker, Deputy Director of the IFG. As well as Amy Bricker, LaDon Sabani, Lena Magni, Becky Spector, Shawnee Hoover, Dolly Ma, Victor Manati, Daniela Gale, hope I'm not leaving anybody out from the IFG, as well as, thank you, as well as Amy Quinn from the Institute for Policy Studies, who really was on the ground with all of this, and John Kavanagh from the Institute for Policy Studies. Why don't you all stand up so we can give you a round of applause? Come on. Debbie. Oh. Well, now we don't know who is who. Now, one thing we can also do for this wonderful staff is that it will be a lot easier for everybody, since we have to clean up this place after, if you will all please remove all of your papers and stuff that you brought in with you or that you have around you and carry it out the door with you and dispose of it somewhere else. So that'll save us a lot of work and time at the end of the evening. So I remember the last time I introduced Ralph Nader at 11 o'clock at night or 10:45, and that was what was it, 4 or 5 years ago, at our very first teach-in, the one we did in New York City, at a time when globalization was not the hot topic it is today. At least we didn't think so. That was an event we were going to do at Columbia University, we decided we wanted to move the globalization subject to the front burner and get people to pay attention to it. And we decided to have an event at Columbia University. We hired a couple of rooms with the maximum size of 400 seats, and then about a week before the event, this was the first experiment we had with email. And we looked at our email, and we found that we had oversold it by at least double. And we suddenly had to move it somewhere else. We moved it to Riverside Church, that famous historic church in New York. And we had 2,000 people showed up for an event on globalization. So it's not a complete surprise that this movement has happened. We were surprised ourselves to see that kind of turnout. But there they were. And Ralph Nader was the last speaker on that night as well. And the program ran on very late, and he didn't go on until about 11. And he was just as alive at 11 as he was at for the rest of us at 10 in the morning. It's really an honor for me to have the chance to introduce him again as our last speaker tonight. It is a cliche to say he's been my hero, but he has been my hero since before most of you were born, I think. Well, at least a lot of you. Since the 1960s, anyway. And let me ask you, can anybody think of any person over the last 30 years who has meant more to as many movements, the environmental movement, the anti-nuclear movement, the campaign finance reform movement, the democracy movement, the consumer movement? Has anyone been more important than Ralph Nader all these 30 years? I don't think so. The media democracy movement and the anti-globalization movement. As soon as we said globalization, of course, Lori Wallach was already on our board and working with us. He had hired Lori Wallach, and so he was already on the page with this subject, while very few other people were. He's always there. It's little wonder that he has been repeatedly rated National Post as the most respected person in America. I believe that's true. Of course, he's also the author of 14 books, notably the great bestseller Unsafe at Any Speed, which was really notable as one of the first direct attacks on corporations, on the auto industry in particular, for knowingly permitting unsafe autos on the highway that were killing people left and right. And he did that book at great risk personally as well, because in those days corporations may have been even more outlawish than they are today. He was also basically responsible for the Freedom of Information Act. He's the founder of Public Citizen, surely one of the most effective consumer environmental health and globalization groups in the country. He's been a leader in so many crucial battles, it's hard to imagine that it's even possible. He's currently president of the Center for Responsive Law, and he's the Green Party candidate for president. Please, Ralph Nader.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jerry, and thank you and all the people who work with the International Forum on Globalization. It really does take a huge amount of work to arrange these kinds of gatherings, and we hope that these proceedings for the past, 12 hours will be put on the Internet so people all over the world can see it and hear it. Not that we expected any of the major networks or cable companies to be here, after all. They're into other priorities. Thank also the panel for their very precise expressions, and they've all worked so hard. All this doesn't get done by a few people. It gets done by a lot of people, and the few people may get much of the credit, but to those of you who are under 30 or under 25, let me just tell you that the key here is stamina. It's commitment. It's commitment. It's diligence. It's realizing that throughout the world's history, the reason why the few dominate the many is because the few are organized. and the many are not organized. And it's because the few disorganize the many. And all this increasing critique of corporate globalization, we should always use the adjective, all this increasing critique comes from a long overdue pattern of research to discern the systems of control. And make no mistake about it, although the shibboleths of free trade are tossed in front of a often misinformed media, the issue with the IMF and World Trade Organization, the World Bank, is governance. It's the governance systems for global corporation that we're really dealing with. It's the autocratic system of governance. It's the autocratic systems of governance that undermine democracy, that subordinate human rights and the rights of people for decent standards of living and for decent standards of justice. This is what is at stake here, challenging international systems of autocratic governance that serve overwhelmingly the interest of giant global corporations who dominate and seek to dominate everything in their path. They want to dominate governments. They want to dominate the workplace. They want to dominate the marketplace. They want to dominate the universities by corporatizing them. They want to dominate the very concept of childhood with their brazen commercial exploitation of small children. They want to dominate the shaping of the environment. They want to control the genes of the natural world. They want to control the human genes. They want to control the seeds. They want to control the future. And we have to make sure that this relentless drive for control by the commercial instinct, which every major religion in the world has warned us about for 2,000 years, that should never be given excessive power, because in its singular focus and drive and lack of respect for other values, it destroys these other values in a paroxysm of greed that implodes on itself. This is the church where President Clinton comes to pray almost every Sunday that he is in town. He listens to sermons on spirituality, on religion, on various elaborations of the Golden Rule. Do unto others what you wish others to do unto you. Then he gets into his limousine and he goes down 16th Street to the White House, where decisions are made by another golden rule, they who have the gold rule. And in watching over the years President Clinton coming to this church, I kept asking myself, what is it that intercepts what he absorbs here by the time he goes down there? Here he meets spirituality and communes with it. There he meets corporations who've turned the White House into a corporate prison. In between, he doesn't meet the people. That's what we're all about. Because that in between is the major democracy gap that must be filled by all generations and people from all over the world. In Seattle, I sat on a panel with Undersecretary of Commerce David Aaron. Some of you may remember. He was shortchanging the dialogue, in my judgment. And in my frustration, I challenged him to a structured five-hour debate. And he agreed. And on the way out from that auditorium, he reiterated his agreement. So I wrote him a letter when I came back. And I said, let's sit down so we can work out the rules and who's going to debate over what topics, etc. And just last week and a half ago, on his last day in office, he wrote me a little note saying he's joining a firm. It turns out to be a law firm specializing in global trade. He's leaving the Department of Commerce, and while he would love to have engaged in the debate, he has to pass it on to someone else. There it is. There it is, the shuttle at work, the merry-go-round at work, between the corporate government and the political government, back to the corporate government, to the political government. Now, let me just put before you briefly some of the major problems affecting the world and ask yourself, to what extent does the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, and global corporations, who, as David Corton said, seek to rule the world, to what extent they either contribute to these problems, worsen them, or even cause them, or are indifferent to them? Poverty, massive problem in the world. As you know, a couple billion people trying to eke it out on less than the equivalent of a dollar a day. Authoritarian regimes. Environmental destruction. Multiple epidemics of diseases. Horribly inadequate housing. Inadequate food, ranging from malnutrition to starvation, in terms of inadequate distribution of the available food. The massive military arms trafficking in the world. Check out these big corporations, these giant food grain exporters, these giant food processing companies. Their main attention to world poverty, to see how much fat and sugar they can pump in to third world's people. The tobacco industry, what's their contribution to health? It's to increase the level of cancer and other tobacco-related diseases. How about the housing industry? They could care less. There's not much money in that. The pharmaceutical industry, they're great in lifestyle drugs. They love to develop drugs like Viagra and restoring bald-headed men and harmful anti-obesity drugs. But you know something? For decades now, even though they're subsidized by taxpayers, they don't do any research in drugs and vaccines for the major global infectious diseases like tuberculosis and malaria, etc. In fact, most of the malaria research for anti-malarial drugs, unfortunately, most of it's concentrated in this country, and it's over at the Pentagon, the Walter Reed Institute of Health, with the Army and Navy scientists. They're the ones who are doing this work. Isn't it interesting, this giant, profitable pharmaceutical industry? They're not interested in drugs and vaccines for alleviating the tremendous mortality and morbidity rates. Malaria itself takes 2 million lives a year, including 1 million African children. We see this with the arms traffic. Who's fueling the arms traffic? The giant military arms producers with your tax dollars. In this country, $6 billion of tax subsidies a year for private exports of jets and tanks and ammunition, etc., to countries that aren't exactly governments of, by, and for their people. And we see it in every area. Now, when are these companies ever going to lose their credibility? When are these companies? Every major social movement in the United States history was opposed by the dominant business firms, whether it's the abolition of slavery, trade union movement, farmer, progressive, populist movement, even the women's suffrage movement, the environmental consumer movements, the more recent vintage, opposed by the dominant business community. When are these people going to lose their credibility? Corporations are chartered by us. We give them the charter. They don't exist without the charter by state and federal governments. And we can condition the charter, suspend the charter, pull the charter for corporate recidivists and other misbehaving corporations and throw them into trusteeships and reorganize them so that they behave. We must remember that. We know how the IMF and WTO and World Bank work. It's no mystery. They're funded by taxpayers with very little consent, informed consent. Billions of dollars of U.S. tax dollars, for example, go into the IMF. This big money-pumping machine, as it was called, the IMF and the World Bank, they extend loans. They have a model of economic development that's grotesque in not only its damage, as you heard earlier, repeatedly, damage to human beings, to environment, to the sustainable wisdom of the ages as it replaces it, etc. But it doesn't have any standards for failure. What do you do about institutions that do not have explicit standards of failure by which they must be judged? Ask the IMF. What is its standard of failure? Let's take the last 3 years. Here's the last 3 years, very briefly. It's contributed to and worsened financial crisis in Asia and elsewhere, and served primarily to bail out the Western banks who helped cause the crisis in the first place. The second is, it's wasted billions of our taxpayer dollars and other countries' taxpayer dollars pumping this money into Russia, a tormented land with a tormented people, once governed by criminal communism, now governed by criminal capitalism. Billions of these IMF dollars right down the drain. They disappeared before they were almost deposited into the oligarchies and into the networks. And where is the accounting system of the IMF? They're supposed to have auditors and accountants. Well, they've admitted they were taken to the cleaners, but when do they admit more structural failure in their operation? Who made that decision? Who made that decision to send all that money over there? They knew what the corruption was like. They knew what the practice was like. They knew it wasn't going to get to the people in Russia, but they went ahead and did it. Did any of their paychecks down the street here bounce? Of course not. Maybe that's the problem. The IMF has bailed out the big banks while impoverishing the poor. It's continued to push its environmentally destructive export-led development trade. Now, there are a lot of things we all can do about this, obviously. But I just want to suggest, especially to the young people here and whoever watches this very wonderful long day event, that first of all, it's not enough just to be concerned and informed. It's not enough just to be concerned, informed, and serious. It's not enough to be concerned, informed, serious, with a sense of urgency. You've got to reach out to other people. You've got to organize your acquaintances, relatives, friends, co-workers, all over the country. And stop feeling sorry for yourself. Oh, those overwhelming odds, the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, the corporations, what can we do? Oh me, oh my, que sera, sera. When you see what your forebears were up against for 200 years and they advanced social justice, which you benefit from. When you see what our brother from Bolivia has just gone through with his co-workers and friends. How can you feel sorry for yourself? If you do, you're a jerk. We need to emphasize the entry of the labor unions into this fight. This is a dramatic new development. The labor unions have been led. They've been led for too many years by leaders who see their position as a sinecure and who were much more indentured to corporate power than they should be. And now labor is beginning to rediscover the demonstration, the picket, the rally, locking arms with all the rest of you. Workers bring great credibility to movements that involve human rights groups and environmental groups and consumer groups and church groups and student groups. They give great credibility because they have all the symbols. The Wall Streeters cannot damage those symbols. They've got all the symbols. They fought in the wars for corporate interests. They built the factories. They sustain the economy. They sweat day to day while their CEOs are making 415 times more than the entry-level wage in these companies. Keep that in mind. The second is, what's wrong with aligning ourselves with more conservative interests? Conservative interests who aren't corporatists, they don't like this any better than we do. They don't like this. They don't like where their taxes are going. They don't like the subversion of our local, state, and federal sovereignty, the largest relinquishment in our history to the World Trade Organization. They don't like all this corporate welfare aid to dependent corporations without even a five-year cutoff, I might add. They want their children to breathe cleaner air and drink cleaner water. They don't like to get ripped off by higher pharmaceutical prices or have to go up to Canada to get lower prices. Right, Maude? Not for long, she says. And in Congress now, there's a strong core of conservatives that are very critical of the IMF. And, of course, the other thing that young people need to do more of is read. Read, yes, read, read. I mean, reading. Reading informs, reading motivates. The Multinational Monitor is our contribution to your reading. Rob Weissman is the editor here who puts it out with his cohorts 10 times a year. And it's all over the place now. And also, don't underestimate the vote. There's nothing worse than seeing young people who are very, very active, as Carol Miller told me a few minutes ago. And then they don't bother to vote, like, yeah, it's beneath them, you know. You got to register. You got to go right across the college campuses, register to vote, develop a block of informed voters. And if you vote and nothing happens, at least it gets you angry. You can be more motivated and more mobilized. Now, let's look at the IMF and World Bank briefly through the eyes of the people who go to work there every day. They're paid very well. They're tax-free. They know what it's like to go around in limousines. They have actually good cafeterias. If you ever sneak in there, it's good food, nice, very, all kinds of indigenous cuisine, foreign cuisine, etc. They go to work and, well, they read about what the World Bank in college, what the World Bank is supposed to fight poverty. It's supposed to build infrastructure that private investment eschews as not profitable. Roads and dams and water systems, electrification systems, etc. And they say, well, that's what it is, isn't it? That's what it is in the charter and the speeches. And they go to work for the IMF as well. Now, these institutions live by these myths. They live by these myths because on paper, they've abstracted these cumbersome models of economic development quite inaccurately. They've abstracted them and say, well, electrification projects, dams, I mean, water, irrigation, etc. Who can be against this? Part of it is that there's a deep set ignorance about how economies develop, especially poor economies. Giant projects funded on the Western model do not work in third world countries. Poverty. Poverty can be alleviated only by cottage level projects. For example, look what happened in our country at its best. And why don't we project that for models of economic development with proper indigenous inputs, of course. Look, we had land reform. It's called the Homestead Act, 1863. It broke up the potential for giant plantations as occurred in the South. What people in the third world need is land reform, fundamental land reform. They need systems that encourage this land to grow food for needy and hungry people, not to grow cash crops to be exported to the West, to earn hard currency, to pay debts to foreign banks. The second is microcredit, the democratization of credit, which occurred in our country with credit unions, agricultural credit banks, producer credit banks in the farm area. They don't need these giant loans to oligarchs and governments that misuse them and only entrenches the oligarchs and the dictatorial regimes. They need the democratization of credit. It goes right to people, $200, $300, $100, like the Grameen Bank has shown, which, by the way, was not an IMF idea, was it? People need technical assistance, and not just Western science, not corporate science, not just Western science. When are we going to realize the value of indigenous science and technology? It doesn't come in fancy names and publications in fancy journals. It just is the result of thousands of years of knowledge. Look at the neem tree in India, for example. And I suggest, for example, look at the great Egyptian architect, Hassan Fathi, who developed systems for building homes made from the soil underneath the feet of the Egyptian peasants, and whose teachings are spreading around the world. That was not an IMF or a World Bank or a consulting firm idea. How about Nestle and all the infant formula that the World Health Organization has said has destroyed the lives of millions of children in the third world? Promoted as Nestle did, knowing that it would be so expensive that it had to be mixed with contaminated water, leading to horrendous tragedies for little children, infants. What was that kind of contribution like? And what did it replace? It replaced mother's milk. That's real Western science, isn't it? How about water safety? I mean, where is the IMF and World Bank in the last 30, 40 years? Knowing from their own studies the huge mortality levels from contaminated water, especially small children. Where are they? Why is that such a big deal? It's a big deal because they only think in terms of big projects. They don't think in terms of letting these societies breathe themselves democratically so they can solve their own problems. And they don't think of getting off the back of third world people. Instead of constantly shoring up the authoritarian regimes and the oligarchs who benefit from the corporatization that is often called privatization of public institutions like water companies. And what about cooperatives? We had cooperatives in our country. They were tremendous, especially in the farm and rural area. Why aren't we saying that the third world needs help in terms of cooperatives? Only a dabble here and a dabble there for that kind of institution. And how about public health and infections? I mean, can you imagine? It was James Grant. Any of you heard of James Grant and UNICEF? He's passed away a few years ago. He was a Harvard-trained lawyer who, in the last few years of his life, went all over the world trying to get regimes to let in public health workers, both indigenous and exogenous, for immunization. It's so easy to save the lives of these children and infants, pennies per life. Where are they with their billion-dollar loans that they don't pay attention to this? What about public education? What about the public school systems in our country? One of the great institutions, the GI Bill of Rights. Why aren't we saying other countries deserve those kinds of assists as well to fulfill human possibilities from early age on? What about giving people in the third world the right to form independent trade unions? In this country, it built the middle class. And how about the rule of law and due process and the access to free and independent courts, which helped us? Why aren't we fostering, why aren't we supporting efforts in those countries as well? What about the whole idea of self-reliance and self-sufficiency? We talk about energy independence in our country. We haven't done much on that, although it was talked about in the 70s. But what is this emphasis on the inevitability of global trade? I mean, most countries can be self-sufficient in most of the necessities. They may not have manganese mines, but for heaven's sake, look at our country. Why do we have to import British biscuits, French drinking water, and Swedish ice cream when we have to challenge the very fundamental premise of there is bad trade. There's trade in tobacco. There's trade in munitions. There's trade in prostitution across boundaries. What is this blanket? All trade is good. All trade is good. I favor self-sufficient communities. I favor self-reliant communities. To the maximum feasible extent, we should work for that. The most prosperous economies are those who build domestic markets from the grassroots up, not those who go into debt chattel, debt servitude, to foreign banks and IMFs and world banks, and develop an export-oriented trade dependency on a boom-and-bust basis where the strings are pulled thousands of miles away by absentee corporate executives and their government allies on the 30th floor of some skyscraper in London, England, or London, New York, or Tokyo. We have to develop, in other words, a democratic model of self-sufficient, sustainable economic progress. That's what we have to talk about and hurl against the IMF and the World Bank and the WTO. They don't either have a clue of how democratically structured economies develop from the community, the neighborhood, the soil, the rural, the cities, or they don't want to have a clue. And what we have to do is not simply deconstruct their systems of control and the often brutal consequences that come from their systems of control, for which they're not accountable, but we have to demonstrate again and again from our own history and from the history of the best practices in our country, of the ways we developed economically to build a higher standard of living, higher standard of justice. Mark Hertzgard is going around the country with his paperback book, Earth Odyssey, after traveling around the world for 5-6 years. He saw the enormous damage to the poorest people, the most defenseless people, from environmental ravages. He saw it and documented it, and now is trying to get the IMF and World Bank to accept a Green Deal. And while I sympathize with his ability to try to reform these institutions, it's quite clear that internally they are not capable of regeneration. They're capable of new slogans, of new speeches that display care for the poor of the world, but they are not capable of internal regeneration. They have to be withdrawn in terms of the funding from the various contributing countries and shrunken into institutions that finally transform themselves and give up their original impact and transform themselves into these kinds of promoters of sustainable economic development. Or just close up completely and start new from scratch. You can critique the IMF and the World Bank and WTO, and that's becoming more and more penetrating and more destabilizing for them. But we've got to work with people in other countries around the world, as this coalition has demonstrated, and as you have demonstrated, to show that the alternative is superior in every way. It's superior for people today. It's superior for future generations. It's superior for the free play of non-commercial values that build a great culture and a great democracy. And remember, every country will do it differently. They have different cultural traditions, different priorities, but there are certain common survival programs in terms of food and housing and health care and education that we must try to foster between nations and between societies. Let us not adopt the dictionary of the oligarchs and the international organizations. The dictionary is not privatization, it's corporatization. The distinction between economic growth and economic justice should be made very clear. Economic growth is not necessarily economic progress or justice for the mass majority of the people. So I hope that you have a very compelling weekend, shall we say. Hope you show your self-restraint as well as your eagerness to communicate throughout the country over the media what you're all here for. I hope you'll send your signals to the White House as well as to the Congress. But I hope you'll go back so metabolized that you will multiply your efforts in church basements and union local halls and university auditoriums and through your email, so that this time it's not just a surge. It's not just a surge. It's not just a movement. It's not just a demonstration. It's a permanent transformation of the way we, of the way we use our time and our knowledge and our estimate of our own significance. Estimate of our own significance. You're in the top percent or two of people around the world in terms of health, education, and the ability to make a difference. That gives you a moral imperative to do so. You have a more, even higher responsibility to do so. And we're blessed in this country. We got to make sure that we got to stop the reverse slide that's occurring here, even here. And we've got to go back home and develop our own systems of influence, our own compelling networks, and whether through the internet or through person-to-person contact. Remember, over 2,000 years ago, it was the Roman lawyer, Marcus Cicerus, who defined freedom for the ages. And he defined it this way: freedom is participation in power, end quote. Freedom is participation in power. Everything else is just the symbolism of the oppressors over the oppressed when they talk about liberty and freedom, etc. Freedom is participation in power. Thank you.